I think it's just that aspect of seafood that I love, the fact that, you know, you can eat something so clean, and you can choose at certain times of the year when it's going to be fattier, if you want a slightly fattier tasting fish, and how it can change throughout the year. It's just, there's a lot more story to it. But then I think fish is just in the blood, and you just I can't put my finger on it, John. I really don't know what it is I love the most about it. I just grew up with it and around it. So I think it's probably it.
This is Fish Tales, a seafood podcast. I'm John Sussman. New Zealand is a small island nation that is a world leader not only in rugby, but seafood production. It is a 90% net exporter of the 540,000 tonnes of seafood it catches and grows annually. Of the 130 species which are commercially fished and grown there, there is one which stands out as a world leader, the fisherman. From being amongst the most sought-after captains for vessels fishing on the high seas, to cutting-edge aquaculturists and innovative marine scientists, Kiwis are to be found everywhere in the world of seafood. Expat New Zealander Mark Irwin is one such Kiwi seafood guy. As the owner of 46 South Fish Co., he runs a company that has an integrated approach to the sourcing, managing and distributing of New Zealand seafood across Canada. Drawing on his background of multi-generational fishing experience and relationships across the seafood industry in New Zealand, Mark has established a unique export program for the best of New Zealand seafood into a country which is one of the largest producers of seafood itself.
Going down and seeing the oyster boats coming in and then trying to scoop a couple of oysters out of the sacks that fall out and then taking them home and getting Dad to shuck them, because we couldn't really figure out how to shuck them at that stage. You know, bluff oysters, flat oysters, so you know, they're a little tricky to open if you're not sure what you're doing, like any oyster. But yeah, they're probably some of my earliest seafood memories, that and obviously catching cockabillies, like little fish in the rock pools down in front of the house.
The town of Bluff is New Zealand's southernmost town and literally the last stop before Antarctica. It is the farthest corner of the British Empire, which, since the days of the early sealers and whalers, developed a character entirely its own. The people and town of Bluff have had a long and ever-expanding contribution to the rest of New Zealand through the fishing industry and seafood processing.
It's a very windy, right, dips into the roaring 40s there, so she's a pretty wild place. You might get one, two nice days every sort of 10 days, and you really make the most of them, and you really get out there and fish as hard as you can in those short windows of opportunity. Bluff's about a town of 1,800 people. Mostly everyone works in either on the harbour, like for the shipping, or with the fishing. Everyone's known by their nicknames, and everyone just knows what's going on from what's happening in the harbour and the coming and goings of the boats that are coming and going every day.
In the words of William Hazlitt, the famous English philosopher of the 18th century, a wise traveller never despises his own country. For Mark Irwin, no truer words have been said. His travels led him to a life as far from his home as is geographically possible, but with strong attachment and a belief in the quality of the seafood from his home, he's forged an opportunity to mix business and travel.
I would say 10 years ago, I guess, in New Zealand, there was a group of Canadians travelling around, and yeah, I just happened to fall in love with one of them and found myself in Canada. So been up here now for about 10 years, five of that in Toronto, started 46 South in Toronto, and while setting up 46 South, went to Vancouver for a bit and to work out logistics, and turned out that Vancouver was a much more ideal place to live than Toronto. Nothing bad about Toronto, just, Vancouver was a lot more up my alley with being on the coast and a direct flight back to Auckland. So, yeah, so Vancouver the last 5 years, it's a pretty good place living, obviously being so close to the ocean. So it's good.
A love of seafood is universal amongst fish folk. A deep knowledge of seafood can transform love into opportunity. For Mark, 46 South came about through a combination of both.
It's homesick, really, eh? Like, I was kind of torn, this sort of, I'd go back home and then I'd miss the person in Canada, and then I'd come to Canada and I'd miss the seafood and the fishing industry that I was, that's such a big part of my life that I didn't realize until I left Bluff or Southland that what made a large part of me was that Bluff upbringing. And so I just really wanted to connect back to those roots. And so And the other reason was obviously having fish again in my freezer that I could relate to, fish that I knew, fish that I liked, fish I grew up with, and trying to also, you know, I want to go home as much as I can. So this was a great way to write my flights back to New Zealand. So 46 South was formed and incorporated in 2013, late 2013. And we had a couple of, one really interesting guy, Rodney Clark from Rodney's Oyster House in Toronto, one of the best oyster houses in the world. And he knew of, you know, Pacific oysters being farmed in New Zealand, and he needed them for his winter, you know, New Zealand oysters for his summer diners, because you just can't, you know, you can't really trust an oyster in the summer because they're spawning and there's the water's warmer, so there's more bacteria. So we were bringing healthy, plump, firm Pacific oysters farmed in the top of New Zealand, Kuiper oysters, and also Coromandel oysters to Rodney's Oyster House. And that was sort of what got us going, what we needed to get that volume, initial volume, so we could really efficiently add fish onto that and start offering it to restaurants also. So we sort of played around with that, doing some trial shipments in September 2013, used his import license, realized this was a good thing, this can work, this ticks all the boxes for why I wanted to start, you know, 46 South to connect back to New Zealand seafood. So I still felt like, you know, getting back to who I was.
The explosion in demand for seafood, due in parts to its health benefits, culinary diversity, and simply great eating, has resulted in one of the most dynamically traded foods on the planet. Seasonal, geographic, and regional availability can provide opportunities for seafood to be sold on the other side of the world, but can also mean introducing species that are unfamiliar or unknown.
Yeah, so we started with Kuiper oysters, and then, you know, added Coromandel oysters to that smorgasbord of product. And then Lee Fish has been one of the biggest supporters of what we're doing. Greg Bishop's really taken a liking to what we were doing here and was really keen to support what we're doing. So the support from Lee Fish and also from Southfish, Calvin, with the oysters, really helped us grow our business and get going, start building some volume to make, you know, these sort of efficiencies. You know, it's like with seafood, efficiencies helps keep the price down to everybody, so it makes it open to more people. So we bring in 1 to 2 shipments a week from New Zealand, mostly Lee Fish product, and then in the Canadian summer, the New Zealand oysters, and then we're also bringing the farmed king salmon, and then bits and pieces of, you know, all the unique fun seafood, good quality seafood from New Zealand, like your Cloudy Bay clams, and then a bit of fish out of Bluff from my brother-in-law, who started up his own sort of fishing and fish packing facility called Gravity Fishing. So between those guys and any other unique things that pop up in New Zealand, it's quite a neat offering to be able to offer chefs up here who are usually only used to things like halibut and lingcod and sablefish. And I've actually, through this experience, managed to like eat a lot more of the New Zealand fish I would have never eaten, because Southland is you know, where Bluff is, you know, it's blue cod country. Everyone eats blue cod, and so, you know, and we also don't get it a lot, like we don't get a lot of those North Island species like snapper and kingfish. So yeah, I've definitely, up until this business, I'd never tried skate wings, I'd never actually eaten monkfish properly. Like, I've eaten monkfish off the boat, I take it home as a feed, but I never cooked it properly until I met a chef who could cook it properly. But still, yeah, other than maybe scampi, but then I you know, scampi is very close to spot prawns here, and we can easily catch, you know, go out and catch, well, got bags of it in my freezer right now. I've been addicted to catching. I think that's actually going to be what's happening next. Is I think I'm going to get into prawning. I enjoy selling fish, John. But I really do miss commercial fishing, and I think that's where you're going to. If you talk to me this time next year, I think I could actually be running a prawn boat catching prawns. That's how much I love them.
The role of the intermediary in the seafood supply chain is to assist in connecting catchers with cooks. Often they share many of the same principles in regard to the quality they seek. However, sometimes there's need for interpretation, coaching and assisting both ends of the seafood supply chain to understand the needs of the other. Working with smaller operators can require much encouragement, hand-holding and patience.
So I'd say, like, my brother-in-law about 2 years ago, 3 years ago with Gravity Fishing, he was fishing for the companies and he was just getting bored. You know, I was just catching fish in a trap and no story and not really know where it's going, just chopping its head off. And I kind of showed him what we were doing with fish and through Lee and brain spiking it, you know, otherwise known as Nicky Jimmy. And I think through that and Instagram, he really got a good taste of like, whoa, I can actually see where my fish is going, and sort of set up his own little packing facility. And I think that's happening more in New Zealand with fishermen. I think more and more younger fishermen are sort of, through Instagram, finding that they can get their fish out there and get recognition for it finally. And I think that's what's been lacking. I think the company structure kind of was hiding I guess today we've got technology, which helps a lot, but I think they didn't really recognize that fishermen want to see where their fish goes. They want to know how the customers were. They caught it. They want to know what happened to it on the other end, and a lot of companies couldn't tell them that. And I think through Instagram, even if you've got a company packing your fish, if that company is also on Instagram, they can kind of tag you throughout the story. So even if Lee Fish is packing it, we can make sure that Dan on the Coastal Rover or Redline Fishing, Dan Harvey can see his fish that he caught it. It was packed at Lee, and it's being eaten at Casamoto in Toronto, and he can see that picture of that fish of what the chef's doing with it. And I think whether you have your own packing facility like Nathan did with Gravity, or whether you're working for a company like Lee Fisheries, I think it's really important to make sure you acknowledge the fishermen all the way through. And I think that's where the change, I see a change happening, not just in young fishermen, but all fishermen in New Zealand, just having more ownership of their product.
Running a multi-hemisphere seafood supply program is not a concept for the faint of heart or lover of long sleep. Not only are weather patterns, fishing conditions, and international freight all primary challenges to the multi-hemisphere seafood operation, but time zones and a convoluted supply chain with the ambition of fishing to order can make the job so much more complex than that of a simple domestic fishmonger trading what he's purchased from the local market on a daily basis.
Typical day for us starts and it all blends in with one recording, with iPhones, right? So wake up, look at your phone, what's come in overnight, what emails have come in, what problems have happened, and you sort of look, it involves a lot of fire extinguishing. You're constantly pulling out little problems, and then you have small victories throughout the day also. So a chef might give you positive feedback, which is always reassuring to know. It's easier to sort of look at it from a Monday to Friday sort of thing. So we start building up interest and taking orders based on what the weather forecast looks like in New Zealand on about a Thursday, Friday. And we sort of keep collecting orders through to about sort of Saturday. And then Saturday night, being Sunday down in New Zealand, we place those orders, or we call them wish lists, to the factories. And the factories just do the best job they can to fill those orders based on weather and supply. And the chefs we work with all know that, we're placing orders before the fish is caught. We really want to jump, sort of get in the queue for some of this fish because, a lot of this great, great product coming out of Lee is in demand around the world. So we want to get in early and make sure the factory is aware what kind of interest we have for certain products if they show up. And then we book space with the airlines, let GVI, the great team at GVI Logistics in Auckland, know what we expect weight-wise, so they can make a booking. And then come sort of Monday, Tuesday is sort of our quietest days because we've led up to the week after our orders actually came in. We've sort of focused on building interest. And so Monday, Tuesday, the orders are kind of sitting with the factories, and we're just sort of, bit of house cleaning, making sure that everything's sort of going according, there's no problems down New Zealand. And then on Wednesday in New Zealand time, most of the product ends up in Auckland. It's been been caught and packed, made its way across the country, and all consolidates in Auckland at GVI Logistics and gets put on a nighttime plane up to Vancouver. So that then arrives Wednesday our time, usually around the afternoon. We've got about a 5-hour window to clear that, break it down to all its different restaurants and retailers and supermarkets, and then it goes across the country on Wednesday night on depending on Montreal, Toronto, Ottawa, Edmonton, Calgary, and then gets delivered Thursday morning by courier. So it's cleared. So when it arrives here, it's cleared and broken down to all its respective buyers within that sort of. It's only about a 2-hour window, if that, because by the time it gets released from the airline and by the time it has to be at the cutoff for the domestic airlines, you've got about an hour and a half, 2 hours on a good day. So, and then Thursday, we're dealing with any problems that might have happened, boxes getting broken by airlines, couriers. We had a courier stolen once, so that was interesting, with half a load of fish. So we had to quickly let all the restaurants know that, hey, your fish has been stolen, but we'll see how, things like that pop up on a Thursday. And then we start looking at the weather forecast in New Zealand again and get the newsletter out there to people. Friday, we start taking orders and then get our orders into the factories sort of, on the Saturday night. So that's kind of what a week looks like on a day-to-day basis. Like, it all just sort of becomes a bit of a blur. You're raising two children under three. You're also trying to live and enjoy life and catch fish for yourself at the same time.
Whilst the world is changing at a pace like never before, with communication technology providing staggering access and availability, the seafood industry still relies heavily on old-fashioned relationships, where trust, knowledge, and respect are the primary tenets of business.
This business relies on good relationships, solid relationships that I think go back from just that upbringing in the New Zealand fishing industry, and just knowing these people, knowing these good people in the industry, and knowing where good product comes from in New Zealand, being able to source that. So, and it goes the same up here with the relationships that we have up here in Canada. People that know how to drive the best routes around Toronto on a busy day when there's snow and everyone wants their fish by 3 o'clock and there's so many delays going on, there's 20 centimetres of snow happening. The freight team at Vancouver Airport, a family business, they break down up to 2 cans sometimes of product all in about 45 minutes, and they just by looking at a box number, and there's up to 8 different suppliers on that can from the airline. So yeah, good relationships really help make a business.
Canada's commercial fisheries operate in 3 broad regions along the Atlantic and Pacific coasts, and inland mainly near the Great Lakes on the US border. As one of the world's powerhouses of seafood production and a domestic consumption amongst the highest per capita in the Western world, Canada seems well-placed to service its own seafood needs. The concept of selling New Zealand seafood in Canada seems like selling ice to the Eskimos, literally.
Yeah, so it's very season-orientated up here. And that's another reason why we're able to sell fish 12 months a year. Here, the boat, there's a bit of lingcod fishing year-round, but a lot of the boats have to travel really far. They're not lucky like New Zealand, where they can just pop out and day fish and come home. They have to generally fish. They have to generally travel for about 120 odd miles before they even get to the grounds north of Vancouver. And the logistics of getting that product from north of Vancouver or northern BC, northern British Columbia, it's far. So the logistics and the seasonality of fish and having certain seasons, even just from a management point of view, means that really you can only get wild fresh fish for about 40% of the year, and that's usually from about spring to about fall up here, so over the summer. So really for the other months, people don't have access to fresh fish here. And like halibut season starts around April, goes through to about October, November, and a lot of these boats freeze at sea. And so a lot of it, you just can't get access to fresh fish. So that's where they sort of come looking for us. And then once they sort of realize that, hey, this fish can be caught Monday, Tuesday, and can be at the restaurant on Thursday, and they understand that it's sustainable. And yeah, there's a little bit of a guilty pleasure because they want to support local seafood. But then I just say, hey, we're a local company. We're a Canadian corporation. I employ Canadians. I'm a Canadian permanent resident. So we still are a local company. You just got to redefine what local means.
The wonderful thing about seafood is the sheer diversity of species to be found around the world. For a seafood aficionado, enjoying the harvest of seafood from a different part of the world can be rewarding.
Yeah, spot prawns. We don't have prawns in New Zealand, and we just wild prawns are amazing. I can go and drop 4 traps and have 100 prawns in an overnight soak or even an afternoon soak, and there goes dinner for a couple of days. They're just beautiful. But apart from spot prawns, I would say lingcod is pretty cool. Like, lingcod's like an really undervalued fish up here. It's basically a ling, what we know as a pink ling in New Zealand, and a cod. Cod, it's got a cod-like texture, and it's a bit chunkier. It's got a cod-like looking head, but it's got a ling-looking body, and it's a pretty neat fish. And they're just they honestly look like pink ling that we're used to down in New Zealand and Australia, except they're a more camouflage green colour. And that's also a fishery that can be fished year round, but the weather does hiccup that fishery a lot, and it can be very intermittent. Another fish that really blows my mind at the size of it is halibut. Like, it's literally like a flounder that can get up over 100 pounds. And so you're wrestling this bottom dwelling fish that, when you think you're catching flounders, but like, they come up massive. Like, they can capsize small rowing boats if you're out there drifting around mooching with a little herring and get a, you know, 100-150 pound halibut on your line. But those ones aren't allowed to be kept, actually. So, you know, they're the breeding ones. So there's a certain size limit on those fish. And so the smaller ones are actually much better to eat, and they're also healthier from a management perspective for sustainability too. So I'd say those three fish are really pretty much like your, yeah, they would be the most interesting ones. And then again, there's only really a couple other fish, and then that's it. So your fish variety up here is pretty, it's pretty slim. There's definitely lots of fish, but there's not a lot of actual commercial fish options. There's a lot of bad press around fish farms up here, and I think a lot of it just doesn't have the data to prove, like, the scientific facts. You know, a lot of it's the same arguments that you see around the world with fishing. You know, a lot of it's emotional based, not science based, and the science isn't really being pointed towards the fish farms being the problem. But there is a lot of Atlantic salmon, which is not native to the British Columbia coast, being farmed here. So yeah, that's definitely a bit of a sort of political issue at the moment. We're not allowed to land wild Chinooks because apparently the runs aren't as high as they should be for the Fraser River, which is happening soon, and they want to make sure there's enough Chinook salmon for the killer whales. But it's all just, yeah, it's all very political. There's a lot of science out there that shows that there's actually record numbers of Chinooks coming back right now. I know up north every year, like Ray Hilborn's been saying in Alaska, since commercial fishing and industrial fishing as we know it started after the World War II, that they've been seeing more and more Chinooks come back to the rivers up there every year from commercial fishing. Because it's kind of like, I guess that's the theory, that if you have a whole heap of baby birds in a nest, they don't all survive very well. But if you thin it out, just like your carrots, they survive a lot better. Because salmon actually, especially when they go to spawn up the rivers, they eat a lot of the other eggs, and because they want to lay down their patch. But if you thin a few of the salmon out on the way up, more go up and there's more successful breeding happens. So more fish end up going back into that pool of salmon that all congregate up in the Pacific somewhere between Russia and Japan on their big Pacific salmon life cycle. So yeah, they're fascinating. It's a fascinating fishery. There's a lot of politics around it. It's the life and blood of British Columbia coast. It goes through the soil. You know, the bears eat it. It decomposes in the soil. It goes into the trees. The salmon life cycle here is huge. And believe it or not, we still sell farmed Chinook salmon from New Zealand, and it's really popular. So I didn't think I'd ever be able to sell a box of salmon here in Canada. People laughed when I said we do. But I forgot, that's actually, yeah, that is actually a pretty special fish up here, the Chinook salmon. And there are other species. There's, you know, coho and chum and, you know, some of the other, and sockeye, of course. And so, yeah, I don't know. It's like anywhere else you go. Everyone sort of thinks, oh, the salmon's it's stuffed and they're not coming back, but then they have a record year the following year. So humans trying to play God there somehow, and then there's emotion involved in politics, and really people just got to rely on the science. And the science is showing some pretty positive things about the salmon fishery here. I think there's a lot of problems going on just through communication and getting it out in the media.
Globally, the impact the Asian consumer has had on seafood retail is to be held in awe. Their love for diversity of range, demand for quality, and keenness to get the best value has driven the global expansion of seafood enjoyment. A fish market in the ubiquitous Chinatown, whether in Shanghai, Sydney, Seattle, or Vancouver, will always deliver. I argue that Asian seafood retail is also at the cornerstone of the culinary diversity of chefs and restaurants these days too.
I tend to go for the Asian supermarkets, like TNT Supermarket. They have a huge amount of variety there. And they also have a lot of live fish too, which I've always felt a bit sorry for the live fish. They never look that happy. But I always just find it so fascinating to go there, eh? Like, it's just, they've got like tanks and tanks of just, you know, even live lingcod. It just amazes me that they can get these fish and they can survive in the tanks. Apparently lingcod actually sit in tanks pretty well. Then you've got obviously Dungeness crab up here too. But TNT supermarkets, I would say, you know, they have the most variety. But then you've also got, like, you know, you've got your local fishmonger stores like Seafood City in Vancouver on Granville Island. Granville Island's a very sort of famous tourist spot with lots of arts and crafts. And Brian there at Seafood City, he has a huge range of fish, including some of the snapper from Lee. And then he's also Japanese, so he brings in a lot of Japanese fish too. And really, there's nowhere else in Vancouver you can find a lot of that, you know, Japanese and other Pacific varieties, as well as your fresh local British Columbian fish, unless you might run some into some good luck at TNT. And then the rest of the supermarkets and fish retail stores and little sort of fishmonger shops, they just seem to just keep selling, you know, frozen sockeye and fresh halibut and fresh lingcod, mm-hmm. and then your Dungeness crab, and it gets a bit boring, but apparently it's what people like. But I think people only like what they're given, so it's nice to sort of it's tough selling stuff that's different, and I get frustrated when I can look at a menu and just close my eyes and I know what's on it, and it's probably halibut, crab, and prawns. And that's where we sort of cater to that small handful of chefs across the country and retail shops across the country, which is, it's nice to know they're out there, but they're far and few in between in Canada. And I'm sure it's the same in Australia, where there's some really good stores that sell a lot of great variety, but then there's just the stores that sell what they think you're going to eat.
There is something about seafood people. Their grit, passion, and perseverance are universal. Perhaps it's the fragile and dynamic nature of the trade that creates them, but it certainly stays deep in the bones of a true seafood person.
I think I love it that you can eat a whole heap of it and feel really full, and then 20 minutes later, you don't feel like, oh, I need to go have a sleep, like if you eat meat, you know? Like, don't get me wrong, I love a good piece of lamb or pork roast, but fish, just your stomach processes it so much faster. And I think it's just a healthier fish. You don't need any, it's a healthier protein. You just don't need any additives. You get a nice in-season kingfish about now, next couple of months as they're feeding for the winter. And just nothing beats it. The oil content's perfect. It's an oil content that doesn't get you too sort of over full and sickly feeling. I grew up eating, farmed Chinooks from the supermarket in New Zealand. I never had a wild Chinook until I came here. But you have a wild Chinook, a wild king salmon, same, we're using the same values as you hold for wild species in New Zealand, in the autumn and the fall leading into winter. And the fat content on them as they're feeding on the bait fish is just incredible. And so I think it's just that aspect of seafood that I love, the fact that, you can eat something so clean and you can choose at certain times of the year when it's going to be fattier, if you want a slightly fattier, beta tasting fish, and how it can change throughout the year. It's just, there's a lot more story to it. But then so is meat too. So if you hunt it, then, or you've got a granddad that farms it like I did, then meat has a great story also. But yeah, I think fish is just in the blood, and I can't put my finger on it, John. I really don't know what it is I love the most about it. I just grew up with it and around it. So I think it's probably it.
This is Fish Tales, a seafood podcast. A Deep in the Weeds production. I'm John Sussman. Follow us on Instagram at Fish Tales Seafood Podcast, or email us at fishtalespodcast@deepintheweeds.com.au. Stay tuned for more tales from beneath the surface of the seafood world every Friday on your podcast app.